more C-sections for moms, less money for nursing students, and lower birth rate during the recession. Plus, we're going to take a look at antidepressant overdoses. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you haven't already done so, or if you're a brand new listener catching the show for the first time, or a viewer watching the video version of the show, you might be looking at the show for the first time and you don't know where to find us. So check out nursingshow.com, or if you're looking specifically for the video versions and updates for the show, you can find that at nursingshow.tv. But all of that's available over at nursingshow.com, and you'll find links in the show notes for every episode. There's a show notes link right at the top of the page, so you can find all of this episode's links, as well as links for all of the past episodes of the show. You can listen to the show, you can sign up for the Nursing Show newsletter, and of course find all of the articles and other information available over there right on the Nursing Show site. If you haven't already done so and you'd like to get back in touch with me, you can also shoot me an email. Send me those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I love to hear from each and every one of you, and I hope that you will continue to send me your emails and contact me about all of the great things that questions, comments, sometimes even corrections if you have them. I want to make sure I'm making the correct statements here on the show. So if I make a mistake, make sure you catch me on it so I can update the information for the listeners and viewers in following weeks. But definitely catch up with me and send those emails in, nursingshow@gmail.com. Of course, you can also leave comments on any of the articles over on the website, and I urge you to do so. It's a great way to share your comments with other visitors and readers of the Nursing Show site and articles over there. If you'd like to contribute, if you have a link or something you'd like to send in, don't hesitate to send those in either. Heard from a couple of people this week, including a couple who are both preparing their prerequisites for nursing school together, a husband and wife team, and they were checking in to figure out what was best for them. Should they go on and get a BSN degree, or should they try to fast track through an LPN program first and then eventually move on to RN or BSN? And I have to just tell everybody that that's going to depend on your own situation. Do you need to get out of school quickly, and therefore a one-year LPN program might be a better option for you? If you can hang out and get the full, either an ADN as an RN or a BSN, a bachelor's degree in nursing, I definitely would go that route first if you had an option, because I think you're going to have a more portable degree, and you're going to be better able to find a job as a nurse at the other end as an RN as opposed to an LPN. At least that seems to be the case in my region. And we'll talk a little bit about that in future episodes. We've been talking about the job market off and on for a couple of weeks here, and actually months actually here on the show. And one of the issues is, is there really a nursing shortage? And of course, there is in many parts of the country, but a lot of the more populated areas of the country, we have lots of nurses. So if you're a nurse that's watching the show and listening to the show, and you're a nursing student getting ready to graduate, there are jobs available out there, but they may be in other parts of the country. You may have to move to a location in an area that has a shortage of nurses, and there are plenty of rural and more of the out-of-the-way areas of the country that are having a lot of trouble finding nurses to fulfill positions in schools as a school nurse, hospital positions, nursing home positions, home care positions, variety of areas, including public health. I was talking to a public health nurse. If you check past episode with Ann Robinson, one of the things she said was that public health nurse, she has open positions in her part of Colorado. She can't fill the nursing position she has available as the public health nurse for her county. So clearly, there are places that are hiring, and you just have to find them. Thanks for all your emails. I do respond to every email I get. And of course, if you want to catch up with me via Facebook or Twitter, you can do that as well. You can find me under the handle PodMedic. So twitter.com/PodMedic, facebook.com/PodMedic. And of course, don't forget the Nursing Show fan page. And we're over 500 fans over there now. So find facebook.com/nursingshow and click the like button right there at the top of the page. Become an official fan of the Nursing Show there on Facebook. Time now to jump on into this week's news, and let's lead off with our first news item, looking at an increase in C-section rates. Now, we've talked about this before, but it seems like every time the CDC is looking at this problem, it continues to go up, and experts are scratching their heads trying to pin down a single reason why the C-section rates in the United States continue to rise. There's a number of things that they've cited in the past, including increasing numbers of women who qualify as obese during pregnancy, delayed childbearing years, so women who are waiting later in life to have children, and other issues. But whatever the case is, there seems to be a lot of instances, including first-time mothers. One in three first-time moms, according to recent studies, have a C-section. And of mothers who have had previous C-sections, they are much more likely to have a future C-section birth. What are some of these issues? Well, one of the things that they're looking at, they're finding that women who have induced labor are more likely to have a C-section, women who are older moms more likely to have a C-section, and they're not sure because, of course, there are increased complications associated with C-section, there are longer hospital times associated with C-sections, and in a time when we are trying to control costs and trying to understand increased safety measures and comorbidity factors, having major surgery during a childbirth process may not be the best option for everyone concerned. And I include the taxpaying public in that fact. Because everyone ends up pitching in when people have more expensive hospitalizations, and because federal Medicare and other programs are not paying for complications that are related to factors that occur inside facilities, we are going to see increased scrutiny on things like this, and we're going to see, hopefully, a decreased rate of C-section. I think that many physicians are worried about complications and worried about malpractice issues and feel that C-section is a more controlled birth from their standpoint. Of course, it's causes a lot of other issues for the mothers, but certainly, there seems to be a lot of issues surrounding this, and I probably should get our friend Amy Romano on again to talk a little bit about what her take is on this as a nurse midwife and what she thinks are some of the causes of this, and what are some of the ways that we as nurses can educate our patients to be more informed about making decisions that might be affecting the future possibility of having a C-section based on some of this research. So we'll be following up on this story. We've covered stuff like this in the past, and we will continue to follow up when stories like this come out so that healthcare news like this that gets released in the public eye is discussed here on the show. And hopefully you take this discussion, follow the links in the show notes, and take those discussions beyond and try to apply them to your individual nursing practice. Next up in the news is a story about nursing students losing funding from scholarship money because their nursing school program ceased to comply with certain guidelines and rules concerning nursing schools. Now, this is something that people ask me all the time. Which nursing school should I choose? How should I pick a nursing school? Are online nursing schools going to be accredited and give me what I need to actually become a licensed RN? This is a big concern. And there are a lot of schools out there that may be pushing the envelope by getting students into the schools too easily, not educating them properly, and pushing them out the other side, not fully prepared, and so they don't pass their boards. And most states that I know of have a minimum standard for nursing schools to remain accredited in their state. If you don't have a certain percentage of students pass the nursing boards, the NCLEX exam, after they've graduated from your program each year, then your school may not be accredited in the future until you get your standards raised again. This can be a problem if you are relying on your school to be an accredited school and you have scholarship money tied to that. So there are nursing students all over the place that are scrambling to find funding to complete their nursing degrees. And this is a shame. So I think it's really incumbent upon both the students to make sure they investigate. Most of this information is readily available from their state nursing boards. You can find out about the schools in your state. You can find out pass-fail rates. You can find out which schools are more successful at passing nursing students through their program. I know the state of Maryland has all that available on their website. So for the Board of Nursing, find out where that information is in your state and take that information and run with it. Now, of course, it also is incumbent upon the schools to provide an education that is going to adequately prepare you for nursing school. You're spending thousands of dollars. You're taking out loans against your future income, and you're paying someone to educate you and prepare you for nursing school, provide you the information and the education you need so that you can be prepared to take the NCLEX exam and go out and work as a qualified RN. So it's incumbent upon those educational systems to maintain their standards at a level where their educators are fully qualified, their programs are stringent enough to make sure that the students that pass are going to be able to continue on and pass the exam. The final, really, for being a nurse is the NCLEX exam. So it doesn't matter if you're passing your classes if at the other end you're not going to be able to pass the boards. So I think this is something that really is a two-sided issue. Students need to be informed and choose the school that is going to best prepare them for becoming a nurse and passing all of the required licensing tests. And it's incumbent upon those schools to hold up their end of that social contract as well. Finally, a look at birth rates. Now, we talked about C-sections in the beginning of the news, but birth rates are declining. For the second year in a row, the U.S. birth rate has continued to drop, and this is cited as being related to the recession. As money is tighter, people are not as likely to want to have children and incur the extra expense that kids involve. And hey, as a parent, I got to tell you, I've got a child, he's getting ready to get their driver's license. And I'll tell you, my son is going to end up costing this family a lot of money as we work with him to fund his driver's license, along with everything else. He's getting ready to go to college and all of the other things associated with that. Now, he has a job and he's working to pay for his insurance, so that's going to help out there. But there's just a lot of expense associated with having kids. It doesn't stop when you stop paying for diapers and formula. It continues on until they're out of college and beyond. And that's just part of the process. So if you can avoid incurring those thousands of dollars in additional expenses every year by not having kids, it's a great way to keep yourself out of money trouble. And there are apparently families that are doing just that in the midst of the recession. This information just released, babies born dropped by 2.6% last year. And that's according to recent studies in a long list of what they call falling indicators. It fell to 13.5 births for every 1,000 people last year. And that was down from 13.9 births in 2008. So as the years go back, we had rising births in 2007, 14.3. So it's two straight years of declines, which is unusual. And so they're looking at saying the recession's responsible for this. Has this changed how your labor and delivery centers are operated? Have you seen a decline there? Have you been cutting back on staffing in those centers because you're not as busy as you used to be? I'm curious to find out about that. As we talk about increased C-section deliveries, there are less mothers having babies, but more of them are having C-section. So there's a lot of complex issues associated there. If you'd like to follow up on any of the news items from this week's news segment, you can find all of that in the show notes for this and every other episode. Head over to nursingshow.com, click the show notes link right there at the top of the page, and you'll find the most recent episode listed first, and you can scroll down and find all of the past episodes. Go back and find the episode you're looking for. You'll find links to these stories and all of the others there. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and we're going to reach back into the archives, and I am pulling up one of the original Lisa Booz Talks Tidbit segments from way back in 2008. This is a segment on antidepressant overdoses. Lisa first started working with us back soon after the nursing show began, and Lisa is we're still hooking up to get things squared away for the fall, and we'll be recording some new segments coming up in the beginning of October. But I thought it was time for us to have another Talks Tidbit segment, so I wanted to bring one out that a lot of you newer listeners haven't heard. And if you've been listening for a long time, well, you haven't heard this one for a couple of years probably. So coming up right now is a previously recorded segment with Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center at mdpoison.com, and she'll be talking about antidepressant overdose.
Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back again with another segment of Talks Tidbits with Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. Hi, Lisa, what do we have this month?
Hi, Jamie. Well, this month I thought that I would talk a little bit about antidepressants, since they're widely prescribed in the United States and they seem to be used in a population at high risk for overdoses. In 2007, there were more than 97,000 antidepressant overdoses that were reported to poison centers in the United States. So it's important that EMS providers, nurses, and physicians, all the healthcare providers out there, have a little familiarity about what to expect from these antidepressant overdoses and how to treat them. So let's start with the tricyclic antidepressants. These antidepressants have been on the market for many years, and at one point in time really were the standard of pharmaceutical care for patients with major depression. Some of the more common tricyclic antidepressants that you might be familiar with are amitriptyline, imipramine, bizipramine, and nortriptyline. These antidepressants were a common cause of overdose deaths until the early 1990s, when newer and safer antidepressants started to come out on the market. So although the number of overdoses has declined since then, they're still widely prescribed, and they are responsible for more deaths per prescription than all of the other antidepressants combined. Now, the tricyclic antidepressants have several mechanisms of action that produce their therapeutic and their toxic effects. First, they inhibit the reuptake of serotonin and norepinephrine, and that's really how they improve the symptoms of depression. They also have anticholinergic activity, and that produces atropine-like effects. The cardiovascular toxicity, which is a common cause of morbidity and mortality from these drugs, is due to sodium channel blockade and alpha-adrenergic blockade. And all of these mechanisms kind of put together will give you a vast scenario of different types of signs and symptoms that appear in these patients. After an overdose, symptoms usually develop pretty rapidly, and usually within minutes or definitely within an hour, and they include tachycardia, drowsiness, and confusion, and then those symptoms quickly progress to more severe symptoms like coma, seizures, and hypotension. And actually, it's the refractory hypotension that's one of the most common causes of fatalities with these drugs. A wide variety of cardiac arrhythmias can occur. Most commonly, sinus tachycardia is seen, but you can also see conduction delays, and that usually shows up as a prolongation in the QRS interval, so we do recommend monitoring for that. Now, seizures can occur, and seizure-induced acidosis can also make the cardiovascular toxicity worse. The initial treatment of an acute overdose consists of activated charcoal orally or by NG tube to prevent the absorption of the drug. It's most effective if you can give it within the first few hours of the overdose, and certainly in a patient that's awake and alert and can protect their airway. Sodium bicarbonate is first-line therapy for tricyclic-induced dysrhythmias. Sodium bicarb actually alkalinizes the serum, and this alkalinization improves cardiac conduction, it increases the blood pressure, and it will reverse metabolic acidosis. The dose that's usually recommended is somewhere in the order of 1 to 2 milliequivalents per kilogram. That's given as an IV bolus, and then that's followed by repeat boluses, or often once the patient gets to the emergency department, they're put on an IV infusion of sodium bicarbonate. Measurement of the patient's serum pH guides the dosing of the sodium bicarbonate after the initial dose or two. Sodium bicarbonate should be given in conjunction with supportive care measures, vasopressors such as norepinephrine, IV fluids, and anticonvulsants should be given as needed. Lithium is another drug that's been used for years and years. It's generally used for bipolar disorder and depression. It can be quite toxic when taken chronically or in acute overdoses. Either way, people take them chronically and their levels go high, or they take an acute overdose. With just a change in their fluid or salt intake, or they may be dehydrated, they might have a change in their kidney function, they might have added new medicines, or they may just have an onset of an acute viral illness. Chronic toxicity can develop in any one of those circumstances. Patients with toxic levels of lithium will develop vomiting, tremors, drowsiness, seizures, bradycardia, cardiac arrhythmias, hypotension, and coma. Patients acutely toxic, so they've taken an overdose all at once, they usually have more in the way of gastrointestinal symptoms, more so than the chronic overdoses, but those chronically toxic usually exhibit more severe neurological effects. Treatments primarily supportive care and hydration to increase the excretion of the drug. Activated charcoal does not bind to lithium, so it really should only be given if you suspect that the patient has taken other drugs as well. Gastric lavage is appropriate to use. We don't generally recommend gastric lavage in this day and age, but it is okay to use that for lithium overdoses since activated charcoal is not effective, but only if the ingestion has been within an hour of the presentation. Another method of preventing absorption that's sometimes employed in acute lithium overdoses is something called whole bowel irrigation. Now, this involves administering large volumes orally of a polyethylene glycol electrolyte solution such as Golightly. Whole bowel irrigation essentially just flushes out the tablets through the GI tract before they have a chance to dissolve and be absorbed. Another method of removing lithium once it is absorbed is to use hemodialysis, and that's considered for patients who have developed severe toxicity or patients who have renal failure. Now, there's a fairly new antidepressant out now that's commonly prescribed. It's really unlike all of the others, and it's also associated with severe toxicity, and that's called bupropion. It's more commonly known by the brand name Wellbutrin. Tachycardia, tremors, and seizures are the most common toxic effects and can be seen with relatively small doses, even in some cases just double doses. Seizures occur within 1 to 4 hours if the product is an immediate release preparation, but the seizures can be delayed if the product is sustained release, such as a product like Wellbutrin SR or Wellbutrin XL. We've seen a number of patients reported to our center who remained asymptomatic or had very mild symptoms until right around 12 to 24 hours later when the seizure suddenly occurred. As far as treatment, activated charcoal should be given to patients who are awake and not seizing to prevent further drug absorption, and benzodiazepines like Valium or lorazepam or even Versed are the choice drugs for seizures. It's fortunate now, however, that we do have newer antidepressants that have been discovered and marketed that really aren't as toxic as the tricyclic antidepressants or lithium or bupropion. The selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, we commonly refer to those as the SSRIs, they've become widely prescribed for depression, and many thousands of overdoses are reported to poison centers each year. In fact, almost half of the antidepressant overdoses reported to poison centers in 2007 involved the SSRIs. A few common SSRIs that you might be familiar with are Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil, but there are a number of other SSRIs that are out there being prescribed. Fortunately, in overdoses, most patients only develop mild symptoms such as tachycardia and drowsiness, and there are some rare cases of cardiac dysrhythmias. Two other drugs, venlafaxine, which is known as Effexor, and desvenlafaxine, which is now sold as Pristique, are very similar to the SSRIs in their mechanism of action and their toxicity. So regardless of which antidepressant is involved in an overdose, it's really important to call the local poison center at 1-800-222-1222. And the specialist at the poison center will be able to help you to anticipate what symptoms that might occur in that patient and how best to treat that patient.
Well, Lisa, that's a whole lot of information, and I appreciate that. That's going to be very valuable to the listeners of the shows here. And we'll look forward to hearing from you again next month.
All right, Jamie, I'll talk to you then.
And I just want to thank Lisa a lot for being a part of the nursing show and, of course, the MedicCast as well. Lisa comes on and shares her experience with the listeners and viewers here on the nursing show. And she really is a great asset for us here, and we really appreciate all of the information she provides. You can find out more about your local poison center. Don't be afraid to contact them directly. You can reach them at that 800 number, 800-222-1222. You can also reach them and find out more about poison centers by finding them on the web. You can contact the Maryland Poison Center at mdpoison.com. And you don't have to be from Maryland to sign up for their Tox Tidbits email newsletter. So sign up for the newsletter and get the Tox Tidbits from Lisa sent directly to you via your email box. And it's a great way to get a little one-page toxicology tip every month straight from Lisa, as well as what you get here on The Nursing Show. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show. Don't forget to head over to nursingshow.com, where you'll find the links to everything discussed in this and every other episode in the show notes link right at the top of the page. Don't forget that I can provide brief information here. Lisa, as she did earlier in this episode, can go over some information about a certain toxicology tip. But it's your job to follow up on the additional information and links provided in the show notes. So I will always provide you two or three high-quality links with additional reading information where you can go even more in-depth, and then you'll be able to better understand how to apply the information covered in the show directly to whatever your scope of practice, your instructional guidelines, your protocols might be. So I'll try to give you broad overviews here, but it's your job to understand the specific information. If you'd like to get back in touch with me by email, don't hesitate to contact me. You can send those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com. You can also contact me by just leaving a comment over on the website or leaving a comment over on Twitter or Facebook. That's right. Find me over on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic. You can also find me over on Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic. And of course, don't forget the Nursing Show fan page, facebook.com/nursingshow. Just click the like button right there at the top of the page. Become a fan of the Nursing Show on Facebook. Coming up next week, starting, I guess, the 27th, 28th of September, I will actually be in Dallas at the EMS Expo right downtown at the Convention Center. If you're in the Dallas area and you'd like to catch up with me, follow me on Twitter and Facebook. We'll probably have a meetup somewhere out one night with myself and some of the other members of our ProMed Network team that's going to be down there at EMS Expo broadcasting live. And we'd love to meet up with any and all listeners of any of our shows. So if you listen to any of the other shows on the ProMed Network or just want to come and meet some of us and listen here to the Nursing Show or watch the show, definitely come by and catch up with us. And we'll be posting information about that. So find me on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic, and you can find all about what we're doing down in Dallas that week. So if you're catching this and you want to catch up with us and you're in the Dallas area, we'd love to meet you. That's it for me. I'm going to wrap up, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. We're going to close out with Matthew Ebel and his song, Downtown. If you like what you hear, you'll find links in the show notes to purchase Matt's music. You can find more about him directly over at MatthewEbel.com, and you will find him there. Let him know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. I'm Jamie Davis. I'll be back again next week, every Friday, with another episode of The Nursing Show. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care. We'll be right back.
Hell, he gives you money, but honey, your daddy don't give a damn unless you got it.